Good evening, everyone, and welcome to a what hopefully will be a really exciting series of Shiurim. Particularly this year, I have never been so excited and had so much joy writing a shiur, and also been so frustrated writing a shiur than our shiur tonight. And the reason for both the frustration and the excitement is the exact same. There's part of me that wishes this year had like 60 sources and we spent the next 10 hours going through all of them. Even though, as I say that out loud, I realize it would probably have diminishing returns at a certain point. But we're going to be exploring one of my favorite topics and an area of learning, which I just find absolutely fascinating, which is the world of Chazal. So today we will talk about the actual world in which they lived, the Babylonian sages, the era of the Talmud. What was that actually world? What did it look like? Not from a halachic Jewish perspective, but what was the world in which they lived like? And then what we will talk about over the next couple of weeks is how the project of the two Talmuds, the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, came to be. That there's in some ways no more important a topic to understand because there is the famous phrase by the philosopher Whitehead that all of Western philosophy is but footnotes to Plato, and so too the entirety of Judaism is but footnotes to the Gemara. And so to spend the next few weeks kind of exploring and understanding how the Gemara came to be is a really, really important endeavor. Many of you may remember this time last year, it was also during Sfirat HaOmer, we had a defining era of Jewish history, part one, where we talked about the birth of the rabbis and the project that was the Mishnah. This is obviously a sequel to that, though if you weren't able to attend that previous series one reason or another, this is pretty much standalone. But what we had talked about in that previous series was how the rabbis came to be. And we had seen how during the Second Temple era, there had been a group of religious Jews known as Purushim, who very much separated themselves. They were very, very attentive to certain laws of purity. They saw the sanctity of the Beit HaMikdash extending into their own lives and in many ways impacting the way they lived their lives. And essentially, after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, they rebrand using the title, the generic term leader, which is rabbi. And that's how the rabbis were born. And they set about to formalizing Torah Sheba Al Peh, the oral law. I obviously don't want to get into the details. This time you can listen to, I actually don't think the third recording was ever uploaded, but the first two are sufficient for at least this point. The oral law that they set about to kind of give it foundation. Jews had always been observing the oral law. That much is pretty clear. But what the rabbis started to do was give it more rules. Give it clearer form. The analogy is the analogy I use then, the analogy I always like to use. It's like the creation of sports. Soccer, tennis, all of these sports, people were playing them for years before anyone sat down and made any rules. But eventually you have a group of people who decide these are the rules of the game. We now reject these rules. We accept only these rules. And that's basically what Chazal did. This is how Jews were understanding how to interpret Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah, through the lens of the oral law. And they set about to give it a little bit more concrete. And we had seen in that previous series, Midrash Halacha, the Mishnah, and how that came to be. And effectively, the main purpose I'd mentioned then was trying to reconstruct a world that had been lost. When the Beit HaMikdash stood, it was pretty obvious how to live one's life as a Jew. But the second the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, we have a problem. How do you live your life now? And thus the project of the Mishnah, which spans very, very rough dates that are way too clean to be accurate, but 0 through 200 CE, that with the Beit HaMikdash obviously being destroyed in the year 70. So that basically project of the Mishnah very much rebuilds and redefines Judaism in the wake of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Another reason that I actually only recently came across, which is also very fascinating, is another reason that might have sparked the rabbinic endeavor, was that we actually have an interesting amount of archaeological evidence that it might not be archaeological, it's whatever the term is when people discover like physical documents. So I'm not sure if it's exactly, there might be another unimportant. We have evidence that in the times of the Roman conquest and in the times of Roman occupation, Jews may not have expressed too much fealty to Jewish law. Particularly interesting is in the realm of marriage and in the role of charging interest. Both are laws which are hyper-legislated from a Torah perspective. Nonetheless, we have evidence that indicates that people were following Roman law instead. And so there's an argument also to be made that one of the motivations for the project of the Mishnah, for the concretizing of Torah Sheba Al-Peh, the oral law, was to try and give more justification, more reasons for keeping the oral law, was to make it easier, was to encourage people to follow halacha rather than Roman law. That's another possible reason why. But we aren't here to talk about the project of the Mishnah. We are here to talk about the project that would follow next, the creation of the two Talmuds, which again, with dates that are way too clean to be real, 200 through 600 CE. The first 200 years of that, 200 through 400, is the period of the Jerusalem Talmud, the Yerushalmi. And 200 through 600 CE, so an extra 200 years, is the Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud. We will be talking far more about those next week and the week after. But what I actually want to talk about this week is what the world was like for Jews living in Bavel. Because there are a couple of reasons why I think this is an important topic. There is a very, very well-known, there's a somewhat well-known phrase from the world of the yeshiva, which contrasts people who learn Torah with academics, people who study and mine the Talmud for its historical knowledge, which is, you know, we care about what Rava and Abaye said, Rava and Abaye being two of the most prominent Talmudic figures. We care what Rava and Abaye said. All they care about is what Rava and Abaye wore. And it's a good point that ultimately knowing what, you know, what color shoes Abaye had on his feet doesn't necessarily make too much of a difference. But as my Rebbe, Rabbi Weider, likes to point out, it would still be cool to know and to be able to understand the world in which Chazal lived. From my perspective, what I find so fascinating about this topic is twofold. First of all, it rounds out and completes our mental image of these figures in the Bavli. A figure like Rava, who is mentioned something like 3,800 times in the Gemara, it would be nice to have a better idea of who he was other than this named figure with absolutely no reference point. Actually understanding the world in which he lived, a little bit of his philosophy, for want of a better expression, a little bit of his worldview, that would be really nice. I don't need to know how many bedrooms his house had, but it would be nice to understand, roughly speaking, what was the world in which he lived. And second, and this is something I think we're going to see tonight, understanding the world of the Bavli actually helps illuminate many different passages in the Talmud where otherwise it's not that the explanation is dissatisfactory, but the explanation when you take in the, and I'll use the term already, Sasanian context, when you understand that the Bavli, the Jewish people are living in Babylon under the Sasanian Empire, when you recognize that context, it just is like, this passage now makes so much more sense. Now it just allows things to click. And this is, I personally am always drawn to either learning topics that make something click in ways it previously didn't, or, and this is somewhat counterintuitive because this is the opposite, or learning about things that make me think differently than I previously understood. As sometimes I like to for something I already knew to click a little bit better, and other times I like to be challenged. But understanding the context, the world of the Bavli, you get a lot of that, and it's really, really incredible. Before we turn to the sources, we are going to be talking predominantly about the Jewish community in Babylon. Why not the Jewish community in the land of Israel? Very simple reason. I could not get hold of the book of the guy who wrote basically the book on the Jews who lived in Roman Palestine. It's an academic tome, so it's very hard to get access to. Whereas the person who basically wrote everything there is to know about the Babylonian context of the Talmuds was a professor by the name of Yaakov Ellman, who worked at Yeshiva University, and he passed away a few years ago. He, first of all, most of his stuff is articles, so it's much more freely accessible. And a lot of his students who've kind of followed on his work, it was much easier to read their stuff. Also, honestly, the Bavli is just a more interesting. This is a personal opinion, but I would say also just because the Babylonian Talmud is the Talmud that we see as authoritative. That's the major one. That's the significant one. And its world, the Roman context is definitely interesting and it's definitely important. But I think we as Westerners far more easily grasp what the Roman world looked like. I mean, I don't know. I grew up in what had once been a Roman town of Mancunia, so I was taught what Roman towns look like. I'm not sure if it's on the American history syllabus, but knowing how Romans lived is a far more accessible information to understand than how Babylonians lived. But so that's why we're mainly going to be focusing on Babylonians. Again, we could give like an 18-part series on just this topic alone, but that would be maybe a little too much. To turn now to Babylon. Actually, before we turn to Babylon, one other important point, because I think I make this mistake a lot. We think that the Jewish communities lived in two locations and two locations only, Israel and Babylon. There were other Jewish communities, Asia Minor, what is now Turkey, North Africa and Egypt also had Jewish communities thriving during this time, during 0 through 600 CE. And yet it was the Babylonian community alone that produced this absolutely, well, it changed the way we understand our Jewish lives to this very day. What's also really a really cool fact, it's the only work produced by the Babylonian Jewish community of note and significance, which is kind of crazy when you think about it. Babylonian rabbis may have augmented other texts, rabbinic texts, but actually the Babylonian Talmud is the sole product of the Babylonian Jewish community, which is, I mean, again, it's huge. So it makes up for the fact that it's the only product by being an absolutely overwhelmingly large product. But nonetheless, it's actually cool to think about. The Babylonian community was not productive in number of things it produced, but just in the sheer scale of the one thing that it produced. I mentioned that the time of the Talmud is roughly 200 through 600 CE, with it being way too clean a date. There is a far more fascinating and interesting and already the kind of date range that's going to make you go, ah, when I explain it for a second. There's a far more interesting date range to consider. And that's not 200 through 600 CE, but 224 through either 638 or 651. Now, what you're thinking is, that sounds a lot like 200 through 600 CE. So what you're giving me is a more precise dating of the era of the Babylonian Talmud. But 224 through 638 is not the era of the Talmud. It's the entire length of the Sasanian dynasty, the Sasanian Empire, which took over from the Parthians in Babylon, in Persia, Iran, last began in 224 and ended in 638. In other words, the entire time span of Gemara, of the Babylonian Talmud, is the exact same, is basically an identical one-for-one with the Sasanian Empire. And even though academics always shy away from saying what I'm about to say, but I'm not an academic, so I can. It seems pretty coincidental that the Sasanian Empire would be the exact same span as the Talmud. And so it would make sense, given that we know the Sasanians were an intellectual culture, that whatever was going on in the Babylonian world, the Sasanian Empire created the environment for the Babylonian Talmud to thrive. Given that the Babylonian Talmud and the Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, which was in the land of Israel but not actually in Jerusalem, are such fundamentally different works, I think it's fair to say that there is something going on in the zeitgeist. There's something going on in the atmosphere of the Babylonian world as a whole to produce the Talmud. And that's not actually a crazy idea when you think about the fact that, you know, popular Jewish music aligns perfectly with popular secular music, and what's on trend in one basically becomes on trend in the other. It tends to be that the dominant society of the time tends to have an impact on minority societies. And so it's not crazy to imagine that the Sasanians created a world in which the Talmud would proliferate. Now let's actually turn to the source sheet. So, before we turn to the source sheet, well, as I load the source sheet, Frank asks a very good question, which is, was the religion of the Sasanians Zoroastrianism? Yes. And we will come to that soon. And we will see plenty of sources where that is going to be important. The Zoroastrian, when we say the Sasanian world, when we say the Sasanian context of the Babylonian Talmud, it's effectively the Zoroastrian context. And we're going to see a bunch of examples of this very soon. But first, keep on talking about Babylon. I keep on talking about the Jewish community of Babel. And what's really interesting is in the Gemara in Kiddushin, there is a lot of debates over the exact lines, the boundaries, the borders of Babylon. But the Gemara itself addresses Babylon and its surrounding environs in a really, really interesting way. Take a look at source number one. Amar Rav Papa Sava Mishmei the Rav. So Rav Papa the Elder said, quoting Rav, Bavel Bria. Bavel, Babylon is healthy with regard to lineage and suspicion. So let me explain what they are talking about here. So generally speaking, we assume that the children of Jews, be they Jews by birth or Jews by conversion, are matrilineal lineage, are Jews. That much is very clear. What happens if a community has a reputation for being a little sketchy, for want of a better word? So nowadays, this actually is the case in Israel. You have a lot of people who have moved from Russia. The Russian community was highly assimilated. And so there is a major question to the point that Israel is, there is a conversion crisis, partly, and now is not the time to talk about that conversion crisis, but basically because you have lots of Israelis who are Jewish in all senses of the term, except they are not technically from the, in the eyes of Orthodox halacha, they are not necessarily Jewish. And this creates a crisis because Israel has a surprisingly high intermarriage rate for this very reason. So it turns out that this is not a new problem. This was also a problem in the times of Chazal. And what we can read source one as almost being a little bit of a reference to is how assimilated are the Jews in a given area. So they begin by saying Bavel, Bria, Bavel is healthy. In other words, the Jews are, even though, again, the question of how much intermarriage was there in Bavel, the point is that there is a general sense of Jewish lineage preservation going on in Bavel. In contrast, Meshon Meta, Meshon is dead. It's another one of the areas. Madai Chola, the area of media, Madai is sick. Elam Goseset, and Elam is, I know what a Goses is, I'm not exactly as clear what moribund means, but Goses is basically something on the cusp of passing away. So they're using very dramatic imagery to describe essentially the health of the Jewish nature of these various communities. So Babylon is healthy, all these other places are varying levels of sickness. Uma bein cholin legosesin. What's the difference? Why the Gemara asks, why are we using chola sick versus goses moribund? Says the Gemara, rov cholin lachayim, rov gosesim lemita. If something's chola, like madai, it means, okay, there's a path forward to healing. Whereas when it comes to a lamb, basically there's no stopping it now. It's gone already. This then leads the Gemara to ask, ad heichan hi bavel. So when you say Babel, Babylon is healthy, what's its width? And then I put in the ellipses that several different members of Chazal weigh in on the exact western and eastern borders of Babel. Letachtit bidiglat ad hecha. What's the southward border? La'ail bifrat ad hecha. How far does the border extend upwards on the Euphrates? Fine. The Gemara, in these ellipses, starts giving areas, the geographical location of Babel, which allows us to do what's always, I think, the most exciting thing in a source sheet, which is look at a map. So this is taken from the Cambridge, volume 4 of the Cambridge Companion to Jewish something or other. And what you can see is if you kind of look at the, and I know people can usually see my mouse as I hover it, just look at this area for now on the right-hand side. And what you can see already is this gray area, which the person entitled the area of pure lineage, but that's what we refer to as Babel. And we're going to see that on the left soon, but not right now. But what you can see is these places mentioned in the Gemara, I highlighted them. We have Madai, which is over here. We have Elam. We have Meshan. We have all of these various other towns that also had all of these various countries. The terms are kind of a little bit fluid in this, in the era in which we are talking. But you have these locations with their various different Jewish presences and their strength. If we now turn to the left-hand side of this map and we see it expanded out with more town names than you'd ever care to read, with you know, transliteration styles, which even surpasses the obsession sometimes I go to when transliterating Hebrew words, but really, really important for everything else we are going to talk about is what I highlighted in red, and I'm going to zoom in a little bit more. There are two towns of particular interest for everything else we are going to talk about. So the first one is the city of Mechoza. Now, the name is there, but the actual location is here. And what you can already tell by the fact that Mechoza is but one name of an area which is actually like 15,000 different towns all clumped together. Mechoza was a suburb of a major city. The city was, I can't even pronounce it, Ctesiphon. Ctesiphon was the winter capital of the Babylonians. This was where kings resided. This was a major cosmopolitan area of Babel. You had Jews, you had Christians, you had Zoroastrians, obviously, you had all of these other different religions that were like, there were like so many different religions and sub-religions in this small little area all cramped in together. And it was also a cosmopolitan city. It was a place of trade. It was a place where people it was the New York City of Babel. In contrast, and this is an area of, I think, around 100 kilometers. Don't actually know how to convert kilometers to miles, but a good distance away, especially when there's no cars, you have Pumbedita right here on the border. Pumbedita is the middle of nowhere. Pumbedita is the backwater sticks. It is far from being a major cosmopolitan center. It would not have just had Jews, but Pumbedita was a far cry from Mechoza. And what makes it so fascinating is the name Pumbedita should ring bells because it's also the name of one of the famous yeshivot of Babel. And it turns out that for most of the history of the Jews in Babel, two of the largest centers of rabbinic productivity were Mechoza and Pumbedita. And what we are going to now look at, and this is what I find so cool, is that there is an ongoing, continuous tension within the Gemara between those rabbis who embrace their living in wider Babylonian society versus those rabbis who reject it. And obviously it's not one versus the other, but as we're going to see, there's actually a spectrum of rabbinic opinion. regarding Babylonian culture, embracing Babylonian culture. And this is, again, going back to the knowing what Ravana Baye's shoes would have looked like. This is just, for me, one of the coolest things to be able to understand and learn, to understand the world of Khaza. One of the most interesting sources for this is also in Kiddushin. And it's the following. It's a meeting between Rav Nachman and Rav Yehuda. It should be noted, it's very important to stress, Rav Nachman is like the patriarch of Mechozen Jews. His students, including Rava, he will have, his students are like, Rav Yehuda too, but he is Mechoza through and through, Rav Nachman. He lives in Mechoza. Rav Yehuda, in contrast, you'll never guess where he comes from based on the color coding of the map. He comes from Pumbedita. In other words, Rav Nachman comes from New York City. Rav Yehuda comes from somewhere very, very far from New York City. And the Gemara relates the fact that Rav Nachman and Rav Yehuda, you know, have occasion to be together. And the Gemara says the following in source number two. Amar le. Rav Nachman turns to Rav Yehuda and says, Yitiv mar akarpita, let the master sit on the bench. The word Rav Nachman uses is the word karfita, karpita. To which Rav Yehuda responds, Amar le, umisne safsal, da amor rabbanan. What's wrong with the word safsal, to mean bench, which the sages use, or itztava, the amri inashe, which also means bench, which the common folk use. Amar le. Right then, Rav Nachman turns. Lechol mar et runga. Does Rav Yehuda want to eat an etrog, a citron? But he uses the word etronga. Amar le, hachi amar Shmuel. And now Rav Yehuda turns and says, didn't you know what Shmuel, one of the greatest of all the rabbis, of all the sages, used to say? Kol ha'omer etrunga, tilta baramot rucha. Anyone who says the word etrunga, you're being arrogant. Or etrog, kid karu rabbanan, either use the word etrog, which is the word used by the rabbis, or etroga da amrinja, or the word etroga, which regular folk say. Amar le. Then Rav Nachman turns to Rav Yehuda. Lishte mar agba anbaga. Do you want a cup of wine and anbaga? And you'll never guess where this is going, but Rav Yehuda responds, Amrile misnani is paragot. What's wrong with the word is paragnos? Dekaru rabbanon, which the rabbis use, or anpak, da amri inashe, or anpak, which the common folk use. So the way this story is often understood is that Rav Yehuda is just in a bad mood and ain't got no patience for Rav Nachman. And look, we've all been there where we're in a bad mood, we're snappy, and we just, whatever someone else is doing just irks us. And the way this is typically understood is that Rav Yehuda is, for one reason or another, snappy at Rav Nachman and keeps on just telling Rav Nachman he's using the wrong, like, what's wrong with the words we usually use? But Professor Yaakov Ellman points out, bear in mind the context. Rav Nachman is a cosmopolitan. Let's use loaded 21st century. He's a cosmopolitan elite. And Rav Yehuda is part of the regular folk. And what Rav Nachman is continually using is the hoity-toity fancy words. Karfita, etronga, and anbaga are like the formal fancy. It's like people sometimes I introduce who try to use the term to whom correctly. And it's annoying. Often when people do it, I do it knowing that people find it annoying, but the English accent, hopefully people, I just get away with it. But the point is we all know people, or are people in my case, who try to use the fancier word just to illustrate that at some point we read that word and know how to successfully use it. And essentially that is a transparent attempt to illustrate, I know words. And says Dr. Ellman in explaining this sugya, Rav Yehuda's from Pambadita, and he has no patience for Rav Nachman's embrace of Sasanian Babylonian society, who use all of these fancy words. And we see this even more in the next part of the story. Amar Le, later on Rav Nachman said to him, Tete Donag Tashkena, let my daughter, he had a young daughter, Donag, let her come and pour us drinks. Amar Le, Rav Yehuda responds, Hachi Amar Shmuel, did you know Shmuel used to say, Ein Mishtamshin Be'isha, you shouldn't use a woman to serve drinks, it's inappropriate. Nishadar Le Mar Shlama Le Yalta, later on, Rav Nachman turns to Rav Yehuda, because Rav Nachman clearly hasn't got, Rav Nachman is unable to read the room, so he turns to Rav Yehuda, is like, do you want to give some sort of greeting to my wife? You know, like maybe he's on his way and he's like, oh, you want to stop by, say hi to my wife Yalta? Amar Le Hachi Amar Shmuel, Rav Yehuda turns around, didn't you know what Shmuel used to say? Kol Be'isha Erva, a woman's voice is lewd, and therefore it's inappropriate to talk with her. Once again, we have a strange exchange that revolves around now the propriety of women in the public sphere. In one case, it's a young daughter pouring drinks, and in the other case, it's Yalta, his wife, conversing with men. Fascinatingly, it turns out that the Sasanian society as a whole, Babylonian society as a whole, embraced to what obviously in its own, you know, historical context, but embraced women in the public sphere. It wasn't inappropriate to talk to women. Men and women could talk to one another, could socialize, could converse, and that wasn't deemed inappropriate in Persian society. However, we're talking about the Mechozen society. The cosmopolitan society had no problem talking with women. What about in Pambadita? Those things didn't fly. And so the entire tension between Rav Nachman and Rav Yehuda revolves around the embrace of Persian society, Persian values, Persian mores, all of these various things that if you lived in Mechoza like Rav Nachman, if you lived in a place where the Sasanian presence was strong, the Persian presence was strong, you were far more comfortable with certain things than if you lived elsewhere. To use a slightly controversial example, but an important example from the 21st century. The entire question which fixates parts of the Orthodox world on whether or not it's appropriate for women to wear pants. I'm not getting into the actual discussion, but the broad point you'll often see with modern Orthodox rabbis is a tacit understanding that no one thinks it's actually lewd. No one thinks it's inappropriate for women to wear pants. That there may be other considerations, yada, 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 but go back 200 years and a woman wearing pants was the most controversial thing in the world. And so, again, we merely reflect the society in which we live. When certain societal mores change, when certain values within a society shift, it's not uncommon for small communities, religious communities, to absorb some of those values too. And so what we see is Rav Nachman, who is a titan of the Talmudic world, is far more embracive of Persian society than Rav Yehuda, and it's all down to their location. It's all down to the places in which they lived. It's really important to stress from this source and all of the sources, no one is suggesting for a moment that Talmudic sages violated Jewish law in order to conform to Persian society, but nonetheless, their lives were very much built around certain cultural ideas and values, depending on which part of Babel they lived in. What's really also interesting from this source is the figure used to knock Rav Nachman. Rav Yehuda continually quotes Shmuel, the great Amora Shmuel, one of the first generation rabbis to live in Babylon. And Shmuel is quoted here many, many times as essentially having looked upon certain things done in the Persian world and said no. And that's essentially what these quotes are. Shmuel heard people saying Etrunga, and he was like, that's a little bit too much. You know, that's a little bit too arrogant. Don't use the word Weltanschauung, use the word worldview. No one needs the former. It's fine to just use the latter. Shmuel must have seen in Persia various comfort levels with the interactions between women and men and said, not for us, not necessarily good. We would think from this source that Shmuel was far closer to Rav Yehuda than Rav Nachman. We would think that Shmuel was the kind of figure who rejected Sasanian society, but in fact, not at all. There is a fascinating Gemara, two actual Gemarot to look at, both of which are fascinating for different reasons, the first of which is source number 3. The Gemara in Sukkah is talking about the Simchat Beit HaShoeva, the celebratory party at the end of Sukkot that existed in the times of the Beit HaMikdash, but even afterwards. And it tells us the various ways in which members of Chazal would celebrate. And it tells us the various tricks, the various party tricks they had. Source number 3, Levi, hava metayel kame de Rebbe, betamne sakine. Levi would go before Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi, the redactor of the Mishnah, and he would juggle 8 knives. Impressive. Shmuel, kame shabor malka. Shmuel would juggle before King Shapur I, bit manya mezage chamra, 8 glasses of wine without spilling. Very impressive. Abaye kame the rabba. Abaye would juggle before rabba. Bit manye baye, 8 eggs. Va'amrile ba'arababe, some say with 4 eggs. Either way, still pretty impressive. I can't do it. 2 of these lines parallel each other. Levi before Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi and Abaye before Rabbi. In both of these cases, we have rabbis before rabbis of greater stature than them. Shmuel, however, it's different. We have Shmuel here dancing before Shapur I, the Sasanian king, real historical figure. The Sasanian king and Shmuel were besties, at least from the Gemara's perspective. There are actually a handful of stories where Shmuel and Shapur have conversations with each other. They chat. They are considered to have a relationship with one another. And this teaches us a couple of things. The first is it gives us a little bit of a glimpse into how were Jews accepted in Persian society? The answer is yes. I mean, Shapur I is at a Simchat Beit HaShoeva, ostensibly. It's a bit like nowadays, the White House always has its Hanukkah party. You know, they didn't have Hanukkah parties throughout most of Jewish history. There weren't Hanukkah parties by the heads of state. But in Bavel, the head of state would attend the Simchat Beit HaShoeva. So first of all, we see it's a nice indication of the acceptance Jews had in Bavel. But it also shows the embrace of Jews towards Babylonians writ large. Shmuel had a relationship with, had a friendship with Shapur I, the king of the Sasanians. The Gemara assumes and doesn't think there's anything odd about this. And that's important because the Gemara will often register surprise that someone did something. And we will talk more about this in the coming weeks, but if the editors of the Gemara found something striking, they'll let you know. Nothing striking about Shmuel and Shapur here. Their friendship isn't strange. This was a normal thing. To be a Babylonian Jew was to have a certain embrace of Babylonian society. Even Shmuel, the great rejecter of some social conventions, nonetheless used to juggle before Shapur I. Even more interesting is source number 4 from the Gemara in Shabbat. It tells us about the practices of Rav and Shmuel, who are contemporaries. Rav lo azel levei avdan. Rav would not go to the Bay Abdan. V'chol shekein lebei Nitzrafein obviously would therefore not go to the Bay Nitzrafein. I'll explain what these are soon. Shmuel lebei Nitzrafein lo azel. Shmuel would not go to the Bay Nitzrafein. Lebei Avidan azel, but would go to the Bay Abdan. So before, you know, Frank had asked about Zoroastrians, the actual religion of Zoroastrians isn't 100% relevant to the sources until now. They worshipped fire. So the Bay Nitzrafe was the fire temple. I don't know if I'm the only Legend of Zelda fan here for whom the fire temple means something very different, but in the Babylonian world, fire temples were where they worshipped fire. Zoroastrians had their fire temple, the Bay Nitzrafe. Neither Rav nor Shmuel would go to the Bay Nitzrafe for what are obvious reasons. It's Avodah Zarah, it's idolatry. What was the Bay Abdan? So truth be told, the Bay Abdan is one of those things that no one is quite 100% sure what exactly it is. But the best guess of historians based on a ton of good reasons is that it was basically a temple annex where people would gather for intellectual discussion, theological discussion. But it was both a religious center while not a place of religious service. What's interesting here is while Rav refuses to set foot in it, Shmuel has no problem going to the temple annex to hang out with a bunch of Zoroastrians and who else knows, chatting about religion. So again, Shmuel embraced certain aspects of Babylonian culture to the extent that he didn't have too many qualms with interacting with other people around him. There is more to say about the relationship between Jews and non-Jews, which actually I'll mention now, because I didn't put any sources on the source sheet. But this is as good a time as any to talk about the relationship between Jews and non-Jews in general that we find in the Gemara. And at this point, it should come as no surprise, but depending on where a rabbi comes from, radically changes the way that rabbi thinks of non-Jews. So, you guessed it. Rabbis who come from Mechoza continually declare positions that are far more accommodating and trusting of non-Jews than rabbis who came from Pumbedita. Indeed, some of the most, you know, well-known questions Chazal faced in, for instance, Masechet Avodah Zarah, you'll often find Mechozan rabbis arguing for more lenient positions than their colleagues. Similarly, Mechozan rabbis far more comfortable with converts than Pumbeditan rabbis, for the same exact obvious reasons. Indeed, there are a couple of occasions in the Gemara where it basically talks about the fact like Mechoza had like a high percentage of converts registering interest in becoming Jews. Pumbedita and some of these other places, they never saw any. No one ever converted who lived in these places. So again, we see a strong connection between the place in which they lived and their relationship towards the non-Jews that were around them. There are some other far more specific but interesting examples of Persian culture coming in. And we begin with one of the most controversial nowadays sources. It's the Gemara in Yevamot. It's also found in Yoma, and it says the following. Vaharav, and it's talking about Mamzerut, and it's talking about the problems of if you have children from multiple wives who live in different locations, is there a problem of those kids eventually finding one another, marrying one another, and problems arising? This leads the Gemara to comment that there were a few people who were well known for having potentially lots of children in lots of different locations. And the following is recounted in the Gemara. Vaharav ki ikla la Dardashir. When Rav would arrive in Dardashir, Machriz va'amar, they would make a public announcement, Man havya la yoma, which woman will be my wife for the day? Which woman will be my wife for his visit? But Rav Nachman, and when Rav Nachman would arrive, ki ikla la shachmet siv, when he would arrive in the town of Shach Netziv, Machwiz Va'amar Man Haveliyama, again, which woman will be my wife for the day? It's a very, very, again, nowadays we read this through our 21st century eyes and we're like, wait, what? I'm sorry. What's happening here? Rav and Rav Nachman want company. And so how do you do that? Well, you marry someone for a day and then you divorce them the next day. Or you marry them at the beginning of your trip, you divorce them at the end of your trip, but during that entire intervening period, you get to have company. We look at this nowadays and we are like, what on earth did I just read? But what's also interesting to note is the Gemara never seems bothered that Rav and Rav Nachman did this. And it turns out that Babylonian society had a very different perspective on sexual mores than we have nowadays. Indeed, Babylonian society, Sasanian laws, are some of the few laws which do not consider a woman committing adultery to be a major crime. It's a minor crime. Lots of things in the sexual realm that we would consider to be big no-nos in the Babylonian world were like, maybe at best, not good ideas. It turns out that it was a world in which certain things were far more comfortable. When Rav would rock up to Dar Dashir, this wasn't actually a crazy idea. This is strange to our ears, but it was not strange to those people who lived in this town. Now, obviously, again, I should stress, Chazal weren't doing the same things the rest of the Babylonians were doing, which contravene explicit halacha, but they seem far more comfortable with some things than anyone else does. And a really interesting example also of this is the respective treatments of polygamy between the Yerushalmi and the Bavli. The Bavli seems, even though nowadays, as is well known, polygamy is prohibited, it's technically permitted in the Torah. The Yerushalmi seems to still look at it like a little bit of a strange, why would you do this? Whereas the Bavli thinks polygamy is just a perfectly non-crazy thing to happen. It's a fascinating example, but an important example to recognize that when we think of certain stories in Chazal, where the relationship between men and women is portrayed a certain way, our instinct is to assume we translate it into 21st century terms. But the truth is, we are so ignorant of the sexual culture of Babylon that sometimes some of these sources are actually, some of these quotes are actually very, very different than what we understand them to be. Another example of the role of women in Babylonian society, again, involves Yalta. Yalta, we mentioned earlier, the wife of Rav Nachman, and it's a good story. This is from the Gemara in Brachot. The Gemara in Brachot is talking about you bench Birkat Hamazon, grace after meal, on a cup of wine, and that's a cup of bracha. And basically, you want to give it out to people as an indication of other people partaking of the bracha. And this time, it involves Ulla. Ulla was a rabbi from the land of Israel, but he would visit Babylon. And one night, Ulla picked the wrong house to turn up to because we are about to have a culture clash of the highest order. Ulla ikla levei Rav Nachman. Ulla went to Rav Nachman's house for a meal. Kurech rifta, he ate bread. Barich birkat mezona, he benched. Yahav le kasa devirkata le Rav Nachman. And he gave the cup of bracha to Rav Nachman. Amar le Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman suggests, Lishtadar mar kasa le devirkata le Yalta. Okay, now give it to Yalta. She's clearly not in the room based on the context of the story. But, you know, go give it to Yalta. Something that's completely normal for Rav Nachman. Not so for Ulla. Ulla responds, Amar le. And the next few lines are a little bit technical. I'm going to try and just get through them because they're not the main point of what we're seeing here. Hanchi Amar Rabbi Yochanan said, Ein pri vitna shel isha mitbarech ela pri vitna shel ish. That basically, you don't need to give the cup of bracha to the wife. She gets it from her husband. Shne emar, the verse says in Sefer Dvarim, uvarech pri vitnacha. It says your masculine singular body, pri vitna lo ne'emar. It doesn't say it in the feminine, ela pri vitnacha. Vitnacha. Fine. So in other words, Rav Nachman's like, give the cup of wine to my wife. And Ullah's like, we don't do that. It's a very common thing also in some 21st century Jewish households too, where some people's wives are more accustomed to doing certain things than others. But Ullah's like, we don't do that. Rav Nachman wanted him to send the wine. Ad hachi shma'a Yalta. Yalta heard this. She heard what was going on. Kama bezihara. She got very angry, arose in a rage. Va'alat levei chamra. She goes into the wine storage, udvara arba ma'a dine de chamra, and smashes up 400 barrels of wine. She ain't happy. Amar le Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman, trying to defuse the situation, turns back to Ulla and says, Neshadar lamar kasa acharina. Maybe we should send her another cup. You might have offended her here. Shalachla Ulla. Again, lots of these stories always involve people unable to read the room. Ulla sends a cup, kol hai gavna, devir katahi. This is from a barrel of blessing. It's a slightly more dismissive way of kind of giving her a cup. Shalachle, she responded, mim hadure mile, from itinerant peddlers. Remember, Ulla used to travel a lot. So she calls him an itinerant peddler. Come nonsensical words. Umismartute, calme. From rags come lice. What we have here is another example of one society having a certain role for women and another society having a different one, and hilarity/offense ensuing. Much as if someone were to walk into our shul from maybe a Hasidish enclave in Williamsburg and be very confused by the machitza down the middle of the shul, just as if we were to go to a Hasidish enclave in Williamsburg and also be perplexed by the placement of the machitza, that's essentially what's going on here. Why do we have our machitza down the middle? Because we've embraced slightly more of egalitarian society than Hasidim in Williamsburg. That's essentially why. That's what prompts our desire to try and make the space as equal as possible. What's happening in this story is, again, a tension between Ulla from the land of Israel, who has a certain set of cultural norms, and Rav Nachman and Yalta, who have a different set of cultural norms. And there are so many examples, particularly in this area. A lot of it actually crosses over into the realm of Hilchot Nida. So Hilchot Nida, the laws of menstrual purity. Turns out if you think that Jewish law, I mean, I don't want to be dismissive of people who think Jewish law is stringent. I'm sympathetic to people for whom following the laws of Nida is a tremendous challenge, but you should hear what the Sasanians did. The Sasanians, you quarantined for a week. It was a much more stringent world. And people have written on how much does one culture impact the other. But the truth is that, again, sometimes what strikes us as conservatism might actually have been liberalism and leniency in the times of Babel. And it's always an interesting point to have in the back of our minds when we consider the actual context of Babel. What is the world that Chazal are proposing? What are the things they are cautioning against? How do they work? There are two other areas I want to draw your attention very, very briefly to. And again, to talk about Zoroastrianism for a second. Zoroastrianism was obsessed also with fate. The Babylonian world was obsessed with fate, with things being preordained, which helps explain an otherwise really bizarre Gemara in Moed Katan. Amar Rava, source number 7. Chaye, the length of one's life. Bnei, the length of the number of children. Umazone, and your sustenance, your wealth. Lo bizkuta talyamita. They have nothing to do with your merit. Ela b'mazala talia milta. But rather they depend upon fate. Daharaba b'rav chasta trivaihu rabbanan sadike havo. And then we get the really powerful and chilling point. We have both Rav Chista and Rabba, who were both equally righteous, equally pious. Mar mitzale va'ate mitra, umar mitzale va'atra mitra. Both of them would pray for rain when it was needed and it would come. Rav Chista chaya tishin, v'tart en shnin. Rav Chista lived till he was 92. Rabba chaya arabayin. Rabba lived only until he was 40. Be Rav Chista shitin hilule. The house of Rav Chista had 60 celebrations. Be Rabba Shitin Tichle, it had 60 kilometers in contrast. What's really fascinating, however, Rabba's pointing out that one's piety doesn't necessarily correlate to the life one enjoys. But what's crucial here is this phrase, it's your mazal, it's fate. And indeed, the Gemara in Shabbat famously, you know, states that mazal doesn't affect the Jewish people, which is argued as basically being a response to the Persian world. But the fact that there's so many discussions, Chazal are obsessed with mazal. They are obsessed with the notion of fate. They're also obsessed with demons. Why are they obsessed with demons? Guess who was obsessed with demons? Zoroastrians, Persians. So many, what I might say are theological positions that we don't necessarily still hold to particularly strongly, are actually often emerge from Persian society. And there's one final example, which I think is maybe the most 21st century analogous example of this, from the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Who is qualified to be a witness? So the Gemara says the following: Muma ochel nevelot leteavon. Someone who eats non-kosher meat because they like it. Divrei hakol pasul. Everyone agrees that person cannot serve as a witness. They are a willful transgressor. Lahachis. What if someone is eating treif to stick it to Jewish law? Abaye amar pasul. Abaye says they can't be a witness. Rava amar kasher. Rava says no, they can still be a witness. Why? Abaye amar pasul dehavei le rasha. Abaye says, well, they're pasul because they are a rasha, they are wicked. And he actually paraphrases a verse. This verse does not exactly exist the way it's copied and pasted into this source sheet. Barachmana amar al tisht rasha aid, a wicked person cannot be a witness. Varava amar kasher, they're kosher because rasha the chamas beina. The only sort of thing that makes them a rasha is actually violence, is theft. In other words, what Rava is saying is just because a Jew eats treif doesn't necessarily taint their moral character writ large. Abaye says, and at this point I'm going to stop the screen share, Abaye says, anyone who basically isn't observing Jewish law intentionally, you can't trust them for anything. To put this in incredibly 21st century terms, can a non-religious person be a good person? So there are some people who will emphatically say no. If someone's not religious, they are definitionally immoral and awful. And other people would argue no, just because someone doesn't keep kosher gives us no bearing on their moral compass. It's a very 21st century idea. Oh, just because this person drove to shul doesn't tell us anything about their general level of moral strength. What? That's Rava. Because Rava lived in cosmopolitan city. Because Rava was used to the idea of a far, far wider set of Jews in his town. And a far wider set of people than Abaye. Rava is a student of Rav Nachman. Rava is from Mechoza. You will also find that whenever it comes to financial law, it is dominated by the Mechozan rabbis, because they got trade, they got finances, they got dealings. They understood all of these things in ways that the rabbis who lived in the sticks didn't get. And so all of this has been an opportunity to get a better sense of the world of Chazal. As we start looking over the next couple of weeks at the how the Yerushalmi and how the Bavli came to be, we're not really going to be touching base too much with the world itself. We'll be focusing on the religious lives of these rabbis. But I think it's a really powerful idea to recognize these were rabbis with wider opinions on a lot of things who participated to some degree or another with their wider world, who had personalities. They were real people. They engaged with their society in some way or another, and that they lived lives far more similar to ours in many, many ways. And I've mentioned before how I dislike portraying Chazal, portraying sages, portraying great rabbis as angelic figures whom we can't possibly understand. I much rather understand them as real people, titans, far wiser, far more knowledgeable, far more pious than any of us can ever achieve. Quite frankly, all of us combined can't come close. But the reality is they were real people. And even if some of the examples from their society aren't perfect one-on-one analogs with ours, they nonetheless serve as a model for all of us as we navigate living in a wider world while also maintaining a fealty towards our Jewish life. And so what I love about exploring this entire concept is getting a better sense of the world of the Gemara, because these real people had discussions and were on a religious mission to further reconstruct and rebuild the world that had been lost in the temple. And they were real people, but that project that they set out to do will be something we will start talking about next week.